and welcome to Joshua Judges Ruth. Thank you. Thank you. Joshua Judges Ruth is the podcast about the Old Testament books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. I'm Ken Lanning. Thank you for joining me for episode 1.13, More Conquest. Today we're looking at Joshua chapter 10 and 11 if you'd like to follow along. Hey, long time no podcast. Thanks for your patience. Word of warning, today I'm pronouncing a lot of place names wrong, so just be aware and just go with it. Thanks. We left off last time with the Israelites capturing and killing the five kings who attacked the Gibeonites. The Israelites found them hiding in a cave near Makkedah. While he was in the area, Joshua attacked Makkedah and killed its king as well. I mentioned last time that we don't really know where Makkedah was, and we still don't. The name means place of the shepherds or herdsman's place, so we might assume it was in a part of the country conducive to keeping flocks. There are two or three suggested locales, but the site today called Kirbet El-Kom, about 10 miles west of Hebron, when explored, was found to contain broken pottery, or ostraca, that identified the site as Makkedah. The ostraca dates from somewhere around 363 to 313 BC. At any rate, Makkedah makes its only appearance in the Bible in the book of Joshua. Joshua and the Israelites went from Makkedah to Libna. They defeated Libna and its king, and the Bible says they left no survivors. Libna is interesting because Numbers says the Israelites camped at a place called Libna, but that must have been a different Libna on the Sinai Peninsula. Libna is another place with a question mark when you see it on a map. Israel went from Libna to Lachish, camped by it, fought against it, and defeated it. Lachish would have had to fight without her king because the king, Japhia, was part of the five-king coalition and was killed at the Cave of Makkedah. Unlike Libna and Makkedah, we know exactly where Lachish was. It lay about 15 miles west of Hebron and 10 miles south of Gath. It has a rich history of being destroyed by some of the greatest empires of its day, including the Assyrians and the Babylonians. While Joshua was fighting Lachish, Horam, the king of Gezer, decided to get in on the action. He came up to help Lachish, but ended up defeated with no survivors. Gezer lies about 20 miles north of Lachish and is also well attested by archaeology. The king Horam, however, is not found in any extra-biblical records. Joshua then moves from Lachish, about 7 miles west, to Eglon, fights it, and defeats it. And again, they utterly destroy every person in the city. Eglon would be another city that apparently fought without its king, a fellow named Debir, because he too was part of the five-king coalition. Now, when I say these cities fought without their kings, I'm talking about the kings killed at Makkedah. They very well may have appointed new kings after Joshua killed their old kings. In the last episode, we saw how some of the Amorites escaped back to their fortified cities. Apparently enough escaped, and or there were enough soldiers in these cities to put up some resistance to the Israelites when they showed up at their gates. From Eglon, the Israelites marched about 20 miles east back to Hebron, and again, like the cities before, they defeated it and killed everyone in the city. Actually, the Bible seems to indicate that Hebron was the capital city-state of a number of other cities because verse 37 says the Israelites captured Hebron and its cities. Hebron's king, Hoham, was part of the five-king coalition, but verse 37 says Hebron's king was captured as part of the attack on the city. This may be an instance where, by the time the Israelites arrived at the gates, they had appointed a new king. Lucky him. Hebron is a very important site to the Jews, Christians, and Muslims, because the patriarchs are said to be buried there in the cave at Machpelah, or the cave of the patriarchs. Abraham purchased the burial site way back in Genesis 23 from a fellow named Ephron. I won't relay it here, but the negotiation that Abraham and Ephron engage in is worth a read. The patriarchs buried there include Abraham and his wife Sarah, Isaac and his wife Rebekah, Jacob and his wife Leah. If you'll remember, Jacob had another wife that he actually favored named Rachel, but she was buried elsewhere after dying in childbirth. From Hebron, the Israelites marched to Debir. This shouldn't be confused with King Debir of Eglon. This is Debir, the city, around 5 miles southwest of Hebron. Here I want to quote from verses 38 and 39, because the description of the taking of Debir is basically the same as for Lachish, Gezer, Eglon, and Hebron. Quote, "Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to Debir, and they fought against it. He captured it and its king and all its cities, and they struck them with the edge of the sword, and utterly destroyed every person who was in it. He left no survivor, just as he had done to Hebron, so he did to Debir and its king, as he had also done to Libna and its king." End quote. That's from the NASB. Verse 40 goes on to say how Joshua essentially conquered all of southern Canaan. This included the central hills, the lowlands, which is also called the Shephelah or foothills, and the desert to the south called the Negev. Verse 41 says Joshua struck from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and from Goshen to Gibeon. Kadesh Barnea is pretty far south, down in the Negev, but we can imagine Joshua making it down there. What's harder to imagine is Joshua going all the way to Goshen, if this is the same Goshen the Hebrews lived in during their stay in Egypt. Now, Goshen here in Joshua 10 may be what the Israelites considered a larger area southwest of Canaan, or it may be another town in southern Judah. We're not super sure. So Joshua's southern campaign must have happened very fast, but we're not given a good timeline. Verse 42 of chapter 10 says, quote, "Joshua captured all these kings and their lands at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel." What does "at one time" mean? The Jewish Publication Society's version says, "in a single stroke." It would seem that this phrase means something like "in quick succession, one after another," because it's apparent there wasn't one large battle, but rather a series of battles, albeit over a relatively short time frame. How short? Well, I'm not going to get into it here because we'll discuss these verses in Joshua when we get to them, but we have reason to believe that Joshua's entire conquest from Jericho to the dividing of the land lasted about 5 years. So we could arbitrarily split Joshua's time in the south and his time in the north at 2.5 years for each. So though the defeat of these cities is relayed to us in just a few short verses, it may have taken 2 or more years to accomplish all of these victories, which reminds us that we're most likely not given every single detail of the conquest. And as an aside, let me just remind you that many scholars and archaeologists consider the conquest model for the Israelites coming to exist in Canaan to be the least viable of all the options, with about a 0% chance that it happened as told in the book of Joshua. We'll get into all that when we wrap up the conquest. For now, Joshua has defeated a number of kings in the south and captured their cities. It's worth remembering that the only cities to have been burned so far are Jericho and Ai. So we wouldn't be looking for destruction levels in these cities associated with Joshua. At the conclusion of his southern campaign, Joshua and the Israelites return to their camp at Gilgal. Just a couple more items before we move on to the north. One, what are we talking about when we say the south? Well, we're basically referring to the land and cities south of Ai. Additionally, all of these cities mentioned in our narrative are in the central hill region or the foothills called the Shephelah. In part of the wrap-up of chapter 10, in verse 41, the Bible says that Joshua struck as far as Gaza, which was a Philistine city way out on the coastal plain, close to the Mediterranean. Whatever "struck as far as Gaza" means, it must not mean that Joshua conquered it, because again, we have to look ahead here. In chapter 13, it is mentioned as a city that is yet to be captured. The Israelites will get their fill of the Philistines in later books of the Bible. The second thing I'll point out before we move to the north is we do not read about the capture of Jerusalem, though her king, Adonai Zedek, formed the five-king coalition to fight Gibeon and then was killed at the Makkedah cave. Jerusalem is not mentioned as a captured city. We do know that David had to take Jerusalem from the Jebusites in 2 Samuel. Chapter 11 begins much like chapter 10. We have a king who, upon hearing of Joshua and all his victories, calls together a number of other kings to join him in a fight against the Israelites. This time the king is Jabin, and he is the king of Hazor. Where to start? Well, let's start with Jabin. It's not that we know so much about Jabin. He is not found in an extra-biblical source, but this name does pop up again in Judges 4. There the king of Hazor is once again named Jabin, and once again he is tangling with the Israelites. I say Jabin is not mentioned in any extra-biblical source, but cuneiform tablets found at the site of Tel Hazor refer to monarchs using the word Ibni, I-B-N-I. If Ibni is the etymological origin of Jabin, or Yavin, then Jabin could be a title, and so that word could appear several times through Hazor's history to describe the king. Spoiler alert, the Israelites will defeat Hazor and burn it to the ground here in Joshua chapter 11. So how does a man named Jabin, a non-Israelite, come to once again reign in Hazor about a century and a half later? Well, I don't want to spend too much time on it here, because we'll look at it again when we get to Judges chapter 4, but there are several theories. One is that the story of Jabin and Hazor here in 11 is just a different version of the one that appears in Judges 4, or vice versa. The stories come from the same ancient tradition, and one editor ascribes it to Joshua here, and another to Deborah and Barak in Judges. The other versions all have something to do with a descendant of our Jabin retaking slash rebuilding the city at some point and then harassing Israel later in Judges. We'll leave most of that discussion for Judges chapter 4. For now, we'll follow our narrative in Joshua 11 and turn our attention to Hazor. Hazor was probably the largest and most important city in Palestine in its day, which would be the Middle and Late Bronze Ages. It sits not quite 10 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, which in this day was called the Sea of Kinnereth. The city was situated at the juncture of the main roads to Hamath and Damascus, at the place where the road to Damascus crossed the Jordan. These were important trade routes in the area at the time. Estimates of Hazor's population in the Late Bronze Age range upward from 20,000 people. Compare that to Jericho, which may have held 2,000 people, and remember that the Bible tells us that the Israelites killed 12,000 people when they conquered Ai, which may have included residents and soldiers from Bethel. Hazor was a large and important city in Canaan, which may have made it a target of invaders. Hazor was certainly part of the larger Canaanite vassal state of Egypt throughout much of the Middle and Late Bronze Age. Also throughout this time, Hazor was destroyed several times and rebuilt, sort of like New York while Fry was in the cryogenic chamber on Futurama. One of these destruction levels comes at the end of the Late Bronze Age, and archaeologists have found Canaanite and Egyptian statues with their heads, hands, and feet deliberately destroyed. Some surmise that neither the Canaanites nor the Egyptians would destroy these statues, but rather a group that had been ordered to destroy foreign gods would, like the Israelites. A fierce fire also accompanied this destruction. Egyptian pharaoh Seti I also claims he destroyed Hazor, which must have been the early 13th century BC. And as we talked about already, we have the story from Judges and the defeat of Hazor again. If we're going to go with the Bible's own timeline and place the conquest in the late 15th century BC, then we'd have Joshua destroying Hazor somewhere around 1404 BC, then Seti I destroying it in perhaps the 1290s BC, then Barak defeating and possibly destroying it again later in the 1200s. That's a lot of conjecture. The Bible doesn't mention Pharaoh, Seti I, and Canaan, so it's difficult to compare these events from Joshua and Judges to Seti's inscriptions from 1290. At any rate, as we've mentioned on the podcast before, many others place the conquest at around 1200 BC, the end of the Bronze Age, which is where we find the destruction level with the fierce fire and mutilated statues. That doesn't at all do justice to the archaeological work that's gone on at Hazor, the largest of the sites in Israel, but hopefully it sets the stage. I do have to at least ask, however, why wouldn't the book of Joshua mention the Egyptians? After all, archaeologists and historians tell us that Canaan existed under Egypt's hegemony from the Middle Bronze to Late Bronze Age, with their power finally declining around 1200 BC. Well, there are a couple of ways to look at it. One is to say the biblical writers were not aware of Egypt's presence in Canaan in the era the book of Joshua is set. This approach assumes the book of Joshua was not written as an historical document, but if so, a deeply flawed one. This would mean Joshua was more of a theological document, a tale told to reinforce certain Israelite practices and beliefs about God and to provide an etiology for a number of features and place names in their land. We might say, though, that Egypt was more interested in the plains and the trade routes, and since Israel was trying to get a toehold in the central hills, their paths didn't cross, at least not to the extent that they get a mention in Joshua. We've already said that we most likely do not have every detail of the conquest. Whatever the cause, Egypt's influence dwindled throughout the Late Bronze Age. So back to our story. Jabin calls on his allies in the north, and these may well have been his subjects. Verse 10 says that Hazor was the head of all these kingdoms, which comports with what we talked about earlier, that Hazor was the largest and perhaps the most important Canaanite city in its day. Chapter 10, detailing the southern conquest, named the kings who joined with Adonizedek. But in chapter 11, we're only given one name, that of Jobab, king of Madon. The other kings join in with Jabin were the king of Shimron, the king of Asshef, the kings in the north in the hill country, and in the Arabah south of Kinnereth, the kings in the lowland and on the heights of Dor in the west, the Canaanites in the west and the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, and Jebusites in the hill country, and the Hivites at the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpah. That's a lot of kingdoms, and apparently they were able to muster quite a large army. Verse 4 says there were as many people as there was sand on the seashore, along with horses and chariots. The Bible is fond of using this analogy of sand on the seashore. It just means a very large number of people. The Lord promised Abraham that he would have as many descendants as there was sand on the seashore. His descendants would have to get through this battle first. The other thing to note here is the writer mentions the enemy having horses and chariots. For a book largely about the military conquest of Canaan, there is very little mention of weapons. The only weapons the Israelites seem to possess are swords. There is no mention of bows and arrows. There was at least one spear in the camp during the sojourn in the wilderness because Phinehas used it to kill a Hebrew man and a Midianite woman engaged in fornication in Numbers 25. One blow and he killed both of them. But spears aren't mentioned in Joshua at all. Joshua and the Israelites certainly didn't have any chariots or horses either. At least there is no mention of them. The last time the Israelites had even encountered chariots is when they were pinned up against the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army closing in, and we know how that turned out. Of course, the Lord knew the children of Israel would eventually face chariots, and he made a point to prepare them for it. In Deuteronomy 20, verse 1, he tells the Israelites that when they see their enemy with horses and chariots, to not be afraid, because the Lord who brought them out of Egypt would be with them. So right on cue, in verse 6, we see the Lord telling Joshua to not be afraid. We've seen this admonition from the Lord to not be afraid several times in Joshua, but I believe this is the last time we'll run across it, which may be appropriate since this is the last big battle in Joshua. Oops, Spoiler alert. And unfortunately, we won't get to that battle today because I'm all out of words for this episode. But please tune in next time and I'll tell you how the battle went and I'll tell you what Joshua did to those poor horses. Until then, be strong and courageous. Have I not commanded you?